C7. Number 9B.
Now, let us see what we have been considering during the first four chapters. We have now somehow filled in the epitomes in the word chapters, those four first chapters which we can call the word chapters, and have made individual epitomes, and now naturally we would have to ask ourselves, now what is the common denominator running through those four chapters? If we want to put them into one category, into the category of the word, then we would have to see that those four chapters must somehow have somewhere a common underlying denominator, and therefore, what is it? So, let's just run through those four quickly and see what they really have been teaching us and what we have found. We started out with prayer on the tone of oneness and unity, and we saw there in prayer that one of the outstanding quotations that Mrs. Eddy gives on oneness was that Jesus' prayers were deep and conscientious protests of man's unity with God, man's unity with truth and love. It was a protest of the fact that man is one with God. All right, that is the starting point. That's where we start out, that's our premise. If we start out from that point, then we have stated the word as the word, and the word always reflects also the Christ, and so the word reflecting the Christ does mean that this attitude must have a Christ expression. The Christ is always that which expresses itself. And so we come to Atonement and Eucharist, to a sense of expression. What is the expression? Again, we had there that outstanding sentence where Mrs. Eddy says that Atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God. You see, first we had in prayer the protest, conscientious protest, that man is one with God. Once we have had that protest of man's unity with God, then the Christ shows that this unity has an expression, an exemplification. And therefore we had that very nice point that man's oneness with God is exemplified. How? Naturally, in the God-like. It cannot express itself in any other way, in any other nature, but in God's own nature, therefore in God-likeness. We saw there that that chapter is full of the power sense, where she says that the divine must overcome the human at every point, that the divinity of the Christ was made manifest in the humanity of Jesus, that God is the power in the messianic work, and so you had a terrific sense that the word always asks for its expression, for its exemplification, or it would remain a non-entity. The word without the Christ is a non-entity. It has no expression, therefore it would not exist for us. Then, now we just listen to that sense of unity or oneness, you see. First the man's protest, the conscientious protest of man's unity with God. Then the exemplification of man's unity with God in atonement. And then in marriage, the unity of qualities. We had there always that because God is not just a central power, but that it is a whole universe, that God is the sum total of the universe. We have there the unity of spirit, the unity in one person of masculine wisdom and feminine love, the unity of qualities, uniting in one person all the qualities, then the unity of interest. We have all that there, which shows that there is unity of identity of interest, harmonizing of the interest. Everything becomes interwoven into one consistent universe. That's marriage, the relationships between all the ideas of the universe. So that gives another sense of unity, man united with the universe. Then, finally, in the last chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism, we had a further sense of unity, that the ego and the Father are one. Here it's the ego. The ego is not just man and the Father are one. The ego means the conscious ego, the consciousness of man, and therefore shows that the way men understand the subjective inward attitude and the inward constitution of a consciousness and the Father is one. And they have that unity of consciousness, of man's consciousness with God's consciousness as being one. Or as we put it, the oneness of man's way of understanding and God's way of understanding must be of the same structure, of the same nature. So, if we consider all those aspects, we can see that the common denominator was always what? It was always man's unity with God. So that perhaps we could put on the top of that first column of the word, where you have word with capital letters, we can perhaps write there, man's oneness with God. Man's oneness with God. Again, can you see why this is the word? In Christian Science, on the level of Christian Science, the word is always the way of approaching God. If we put that onto a higher level of divine science, then we can't anymore say it's the way of approaching, how man approaches God. There is no more approaching, but what is then left if we take away the human sense? Then we just have man's oneness with God. So that from the highest standpoint, naturally, of divine signs of oneness, we just have the aspect man one with God. You see, not God one with man. It's man one with God. The attitude of the word is here that it is the highest sense of the approach. Naturally, if we translate that man's oneness with God, translated to the lower level of Christian Science, we say, because fundamentally man is one with God, therefore, translated to the human level, man must approach God as the very first step. So that humanly we would have there man's approach to God. Or we could even take in all three levels and see how they work and could see, well, here is on divine science the very fact that man is one with God's nature. He is absolutely one with the whole nature of God. If you translate that to the level of absolute Christian science, then you would have to see that man participates, so to say, in God's revelation of himself, because the moment we say man is one with God and translate it to the point of idea, we would have to see what kind of a God is that. We would have to know the nature of God. What is the nature of God? And the nature of God would have to be revealed to us in order to know with what we are one. So that you would have there the revelation of God's nature. And translated right down to the level of Christian Science, we would see that it would have to give us the way how to approach the nature of God. Now, if you have a good knowledge of what we have in the textbook matrix, then you would see that actually in the textbook matrix there, where we have the word, we don't have man's oneness with God there, but the revelation of God's nature. See? So you can see how the textbook matrix is somehow the translated sense of the oneness matrix. And in this way we can culture very nicely our dimensional sense of being and always see that one identity does translate itself into many phenomena without losing its identity. It appears always different, and yet it's always the same fundamental identity. I showed this now quickly because I would like, with one or the other example, always to indicate how this oneness matrix which we are working on is somehow always interlocked with the textbook matrix. I can't do that with every chapter and every time because it would take up a lot of our time. And so I also want to say that when I went through the four chapters, I took the chapter on prayer as an example and showed there how the law of oneness translated itself to the law of the level of absolute Christian Science, and then showed how it translated itself to the level of Christian Science. I didn't do that with every chapter. I just wanted to indicate how this interlocking is there. But naturally, everyone can do that for himself. He just has to take the textbook matrix, the book on the textbook structure, and see what we have there as subjects in every chapter, and perhaps for himself really can consider the translated sense, because there we have in the textbook matrix as presented in the structure book, there we have usually as the subjects of a chapter, really the Christian Science level. How it appears in the human and what happens in the human. So there we have it, and one just could compare that. Yes. All right. So we would have now the first column. But now we could go to the next chapter and therefore also to the next column. We know that in the structure of the Christian Science textbook, the second four chapter have a sense of the Christ. In our textbook matrix, we could see that here the Christ does indicate how God translates itself to the point of man and to idea, that is the main object of that matrix, the translation of God to idea. And you can see this is This was the sense of absolute Christian Science. Can you think back to that matrix and how we showed in the textbook matrix that Christ as God translating itself to the point of idea had its impact on the level of Christian Science? How? By retranslating evil back into good, retranslating the wrong back into the right. And so that the four chapters were all showing four aspects of the retranslation of matter back into spirit, of error back into spirit, of belief back into consciousness. Can you see what we did there in the textbook matrix, where we had the absolute sense as a vertical? The index I was the absolute sense, God translating himself to the point of idea. Then the index J, what is the effect in the human, which would be therefore the level of Christian Science, and was showing how all that was wrong in the human is retranslated back into the right. Now that was the textbook matrix, and now we come to the oneness matrix, and we can see, but why is it possible that in absolute Christian Science, God translates himself to the point of idea? And so we have to find the authority on a higher level for that, in the level of divine science. And therefore we will find there a sense of oneness. We'll see what kind of a sense of oneness that is from which it draws. Actually, we could more or less deduce it right away. Therefore, it must be the oneness of God and man, and not of man with God. So that the oneness of God and man would mean you go out from God and see that God has a unity with man, not only man with God. But in order to see that clearer, I think we just leave that first open and make first an analysis of the four chapters, and then by inductions try to see, when we have considered these four chapters and have seen what kind of a oneness they indicate, then from there make, through the method of induction, arrive at the fundamental principle of it. So let's take animal magnetism unmasked. This chapter is a very short chapter, and it's a chapter that we know perhaps rather well, on which I have written a whole book, Animal Magnetism Unmasked, to analyze this very important subject, that subject which seems to be, so to say, a key subject for understanding. A key subject because we can see that only by handling the belief of animal magnetism, which tries to veil our vision, to veil our understanding, only by tearing away the veil can we really see reality. And therefore, unless we handle animal magnetism, we are perhaps too much mesmerized in old belief, in old concept, in old models of thinking, so that we can never really let the revelation of God in. If we go back to the fourth chapter, we see there, Mrs. Eddy has stated that there is but one spirit. She has already stated nothing is real but God and his ideas. So there is one spirit. That spirit is God and his ideas. This one spirit as God and his ideas, the only reality there is. Therefore she was stating there evil has no reality. It is simply It is neither person, place, nor thing, that it is simply a belief, an illusion of material sense. So the statement of the nothingness of evil was already given in the fourth chapter. But the animal magnetism is still necessary in order to show that this reality of God and his ideas, the only reality, has power, that it has in itself a manifesting power, and manifesting the power brings forth only the reality of things good. The word is a statement, the Christ is always the manifesting power. So just by making statements about evil not being real and spirit being all does not really lead very far. It is a good beginning, but it's only a beginning. But it is not the end. So we have to see that we take in also the aspect and the standpoint of the Christ into our consciousness and begin to see that in this one reality lies the only power of expression, and that naturally what is being expressed can only be of the same nature as God, and this we call good. Good is not a moral term, it's not an ethical term, it's not an evaluation against evil. Good is saying that something has the same quality as its origin, God, God, good. Therefore, from the point of view of oneness, we see that God is the only power of manifestation. Whereas spiritualism just has stated that evil is no reality, good is all, spirit is all, spirit is all, God and his idea. Now we have a sense that there is only one power of manifestating this good, and that there is no manifestation of evil. So the accent is not so much perhaps on good or on evil, not so much on reality or unreality, but much more on the power sense of the Christ, the power to manifest itself, showing in the oneness that God operates only as good, never as something else. So that there is only one power of manifestation, God, good. If one reads through this chapter, this is perhaps especially characteristic for what we do in the way of analyzing the text. In this chapter, practically everything is written from another level than from the level of divine science. Or, to put this statement into the positive sense, there are only very few sentences in that whole chapter that state something from the level of divine science. All the rest is practically on the level of Christian science or on the level of what is below Christian science of animal magnetism. What are these big statements that are in this chapter? And there are perhaps just one or two. When she says, mind science is of God and demonstrates the divine principle, working out the purposes of good only. So here you have a statement that does not take in anything relative, that is not related to animal magnetism as such, but really is the answer to animal magnetism on the level of divine science, that it only working out the purposes of good. Or you take the other statement, which is even more conclusive for this level. She says the maximum of good is the infinite God and his idea, the all in all. Now this is typically divine science, the level of divine science. So practically all the rest is a translated form from divine science to absolute Christian science, and even there just a few statements, and then right down to the level of Christian science, bringing out and showing how the claims of animal magnetism are a misconception, really, of the science of mind. Therefore, we could perhaps write into our box there on animal magnetism as a oneness sense. We could perhaps write, only one power of manifestation. Only one power of manifestation, : God good. Yeah. Actually, we could have put it grammatically also different, but you know what it means. We could have said, God good is the only power of manifestation, something like that. But you can see what it implies at once, that here we really feel that there is only one power of manifestation. Now, can you see that this is giving a different tonality than what we had in the first four chapters? There, we didn't have that sense of the power of manifestation. It was much more a stating of man's unity with God, except where did we have a little sense of manifestation in the first four chapters? Huh? In a chapter on Atonement and Eucharist. There we said that this unity has its exemplification. Can you see? But naturally we have it there a little bit because it's the chapter on the Word as the Christ. So it had to have some little touch of the Christ in it.